welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for October 1st, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, measuring group intelligence, pioneering studies of preserved ancient molecules, and we read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about the world's toughest biological material, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
It was 1904 when psychologist Charles Spearman first published his article that a person's general intelligence could be objectively determined and measured. Not long after, the intelligence quotient, or IQ test, was developed, but so was the concept of social intelligence. By the 1980s, there were theories of multiple intelligences and emotional intelligence, with an explicit understanding that a person's true intelligence was more than just how well he or she could perform on an IQ test, but how well that person worked with others, too. Now, in a paper published online by Science, Anita Williams-Woolley and colleagues provide evidence for a collective intelligence and a test that measures the collective intelligence of a group. The research suggests that it's not an individual's IQ that contributes to the higher collective intelligence of the group, but a person's level of what is called social sensitivity. In addition, higher collective intelligence in a group is correlated with taking turns in conversation, as well as the proportion of women in the group. I spoke with Woolley from our office at Carnegie Mellon University.
We build on some traditional notions of individual intelligence to explore collective intelligence in groups. So in order for somebody to conclude that an individual is intelligent, you would observe their performance in a number of different situations. And, you know, based on the consistency, you would say, oh, that person is intelligent or they're not intelligent. And so similarly, we expose groups to a bunch of different types of tasks, and we observe the consistency in how groups perform across these types of tasks, which we argue provides evidence for a kind of general underlying collective intelligence characterizing how groups perform. And this can be useful for a number of things, most importantly probably predicting how a particular group is going to perform on a task in the future. If we can measure their collective intelligence, that enables us to predict how they'll perform in the future.
And is there something that enabled this kind of group intelligence testing only now? Some new technology, something like that?
Well, we were really building on techniques that were devised for exploring individual intelligence. So when Spearman first began his inquiry into individual intelligence, you know, he really innovated in the precursors to what is now, you know, considered factor analysis. So detecting the underlying correlational pattern among different variables. And so that's the same approach, and those are the same techniques we use for detecting the underlying pattern in group performance.
So it's detecting this underlying group performance correlation. That's how you and your team know that collective intelligence exists in the first place?
That's right. It's by looking across, you know, the performance of a group on a number of different tasks and the fact that they're positively correlated. So groups that perform well at one thing tend to perform well at, you know, multiple other things, or, you know, poorly on one, also poorly on others.
And in your test, what, if any, factors did you discover about the individual members of the group that correlates with higher collective group intelligence?
Well, so we measured the intelligence of the individuals. And first, we just looked at the relationship between individual member intelligence and the group's collective intelligence. And in our first study, they weren't correlated at all significantly. In the second study, there was a weak correlation. But then what we did is we also used both knowledge of the individual intelligence of members and the group's collective intelligence to predict how a particular group would perform on a more complex task, kind of later in the lab session. And when we pit those two together in trying to predict their later performance, the individual IQs of members were not predictive at all. Only the collective intelligence factor was predictive.
So not any correlation with the individual intelligence of the consensus builder or natural leader of the group?
No. So we looked at average member intelligence. We looked at the intelligence of the smartest member. We looked at the intelligence of the least smart member, and we found no significant predictions there.
Did you identify personality-wise, who is the leader and test and see if that person was perhaps the reason for the collective group performance being what it was?
No, that's not something we explored in this study. We looked at other features of the group. So personality, for example, we used the Big Five personality factor framework, and normally extroverts would tend to be the leaders, and there was no correlation between the highest extroversion score and collective intelligence. The one thing that was predictive was the social sensitivity of group members. And that did have a significant relationship with collective intelligence.
Before we get to that, what were these group tasks that you had the participants in your study perform?
Well, there were a range of tasks that we sampled from task taxonomy that was developed by another group's researcher by the name of Joseph McGrath. So we sampled from these different task domains that he identified. And these are task domains that require fundamentally different processes for groups to collaborate. So tasks like brainstorming, where, you know, more ideas are better and you just try to get everybody to produce as much as possible. But then we had other tasks where they would be trying to solve problems and there's one right answer. So they have to come to a consensus on the task and identify who knows about this task domain. We had a moral judgment task where they had to consider, you know, sort of the balanced perspectives and moral issues of different people, you know, in a sort of conflictual situation. And we also had tasks where they had to physically coordinate their inputs. So an example of that, they typed together in a shared online document. They retyped text, so they have to coordinate their inputs to type as much as possible without errors and so on. So a kind of range of things that tap into different types of group processes.
Now, you mentioned social sensitivity. What is social sensitivity as a factor that predicts how well a group interacts and performs on one of these collective intelligence tests?
Well, there's a whole range of research now going on related to all kinds of factors that tap into emotional intelligence, you know, ability to read nonverbal cues and that sort of thing. This particular test was developed not by us, but by another researcher, Simon Baron-Cohen, who test the ability of people to interpret the facial expressions of others. And initially, interest in developing this test was to diagnose people who had autism or autism spectrum disorders, because that's something that those people struggle with. But what they found is that that test actually could reliably differentiate even among people, you know, within the, quote, normal end of the spectrum. And so in this particular test, there are photographs of mostly the eye area of individual faces, and then the respondent has four choices for determining what it is this person seems to be thinking and feeling. And so they call it the reading the mind in the eyes test. And so it taps into how well the individual is able to adopt the perspective of somebody else and to read, you know, what emotions or thoughts they might be trying to communicate nonverbally.
So when a group member's social sensitivity was really high, that really influenced the group, or overall everyone's social sensitivity had to be high for the group to have higher collective intelligence?
Well, average and highest group member social sensitivity were both significantly positively correlated with group collective intelligence. So I don't recall if there was a relationship with the lowest social sensitivity, but the average was certainly very influential.
And social sensitivity was it? Anything about the factors of the group and how they interacted, perhaps, that yielded higher collective intelligence?
Yeah, the main behavioral factor that we picked up was something we picked up using what we call social badges or sociometric badge technology that was developed by one of our co-authors at the MIT Media Lab. And what this picks up is patterns in spoken communication as well as nonverbal communication. And the key thing that we picked up that was predictive was how evenly distributed the conversational turn-taking was among group members. So groups that had more even patterns of conversational turn-taking, meaning that they all contributed, you know, relatively similarly to the group interaction, had higher collective intelligence. However, if that was very skewed, if certain people dominated the conversation, then the group was less collectively intelligent.
Now you've talked about two different factors that related to that higher collective intelligence, that being higher social sensitivity and equality in turn-taking. Was there anything else?
Well, there was one other factor, and it was one that we didn't quite expect, which was the proportion of females in the group. In fact, initially we didn't even really analyze that, but one of our collaborators, you know, pointed it out as we were just doing our initial exploratory analyses. And so we looked into it further, and lo and behold, the more women in the group, the more collectively intelligent the group was. However, as we explored it a bit further, what we found is that the effect was largely explained by social sensitivity. So on average, this has been found to be true in other studies, and it was also true in ours. Women tend to score higher on measures of social intelligence, social sensitivity, and that was true in our sample. And when you factor that into the analysis, then that explains most of the effect of the proportion of women.
So it's not as if you have a group that has a high average social sensitivity, a really good equality and distribution of this sort of turn-taking in conversations, and then you add more women to the group, and suddenly everything gets better.
Well, that would only be true if those women are higher in social sensitivity, according to our data. So the other way to look at it is if you're composing a group and you don't have information on the social sensitivity of the members, your better bet is to incorporate a fair number of women because on average they'll be higher. But if you have that information and you happen to know the men in the group are high on social sensitivity, then it has less of an effect.
So each separate factor, the social sensitivity and the equality and distribution and conversational turn-taking, each one of those by itself is a predictor of higher collective intelligence.
That's right.
Are they additive?
To some degree, although once you start putting everything into the equation, it's really the social sensitivity piece that remains the strongest. But there is a unique part of the variance that is accounted for by the other pieces you mentioned.
Now, you said that if a woman were, say, added to a group in which you didn't have any idea about average social sensitivity and that that might increase the group's intelligence, could you point out to a group that they weren't taking turns, say, in conversation and raise their collective intelligence that way?
Yeah, that's definitely a possibility, and that is something that is being explored. Again, the group at MIT is working on visual displays that give groups real-time feedback in terms of the distribution of conversational turn-taking. So that's certainly an intervention that can and should be explored.
Any other interventions planned or thought through?
Well, the next step for us, I think, is to also start thinking about technology. Unlike an individual, you know, we don't usually think of individual intelligence as something you can increase. You know, group intelligence, collective intelligence certainly seems like something that you could. And so we all have this notion that, you know, we're smarter given the technological tools that are available to us now, and certainly many of us collaborate using technology. And what we hope is that this will provide a good basis for which to explore and maybe even quantify the benefit of these tools.
Are you thinking of starting a collective intelligence testing company or anything like that?
I'm an academic, so if anybody does, I just hope they let me collect some data about it.
Anita Williams Woolley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anita Williams Woolley of Carnegie Mellon University is lead author of a paper on evidence for a collective intelligence factor in the performance of human groups. Find the paper online at scienceexpress.org. Also in this week's Science, pulsating auroras. The type of auroras known as pulsating auroras, which appear to blink in the Earth's polar skies as quickly as every 5 seconds, are excited by modulated downward streaming electrons. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Toshi Nishimura and colleagues report evidence for what drives this electron precipitation that causes one of nature's most spectacular displays. Simultaneously observing a pulsating aurora from the ground and from space, the team found that changes in the pulsating aurora are driven by what are called chorus waves, a type of electromagnetic wave that occurs naturally in the planet's magnetosphere. Read the paper, Identifying the Driver of Pulsating Aurora, in this week's Science.
The conference I attended was the International Symposium on Biomolecular Archaeology, which is an unusual meeting of people who are doing archaeology by looking at the molecules in bones and artifacts.
Science's John Travis reports in this week's issue on pioneering studies of preserved molecules, including RNA and proteins, and what the field of biomolecular archaeology may be able to tell us about our past.
So they're not studying the shape of the bones or how old they are, but more the content of them. And they can learn a lot of different things about them that you can't tell just by shape. you can get ancient DNA, for example.
And is there already consensus about which methodologies are best for studying these ancient molecules?
Well, for ancient DNA, it's a relatively mature field at this point. They've been doing it for about 20 years, and they had a lot of growing pains dealing with contamination and other issues. Usually the DNA is fragmented, and it's tough to get a usable sequence from it. But the methods have really improved, and so I would say for ancient DNA, it's a pretty established technology. But what this meeting certainly put on display was that there are new technologies, new methods that are going to be of great use to the archaeologists. People were doing, for example, ancient RNA and ancient proteomics, which is looking at the protein fragments that you can tease out of bones. So those areas are much newer and are going to take some work to perfect, but they also hold a lot of promise.
So far, then, what are some more specific examples of what scientists have been able to tease out from the analysis of these ancient RNA materials and proteomics?
For ancient RNA, there were two studies that were highlighted at this meeting, and both of them focused on ancient seeds. Seeds are designed to store genetic material without it being degraded or any harm coming from it, and a couple of researchers thought that they might be able to find RNA inside those seeds. DNA is a much hardier molecule than RNA, so most people haven't looked for RNA. But these two groups actually did, and one looked at barley, and the other one was looking at ancient maize samples, corn, from around the Americas. And they indeed were able to get RNA from both seeds, and they're still trying to understand what those RNAs are and what information it can tell them, but they showed that it could work.
The hope being?
Well, RNA is useful because it gives you a snapshot of what genes are turned on. You can look at the DNA and a particular maize or corn will have the same genetic sequence, but you don't know which of those genes are turned on. If you can tease out the RNA, you can say, oh, it was using this gene. So if you take two different seeds, they may have the same genetic sequence, but one, for example, might have turned on a gene that helped for drought resistance, whereas the other one didn't. So you can learn something different about the seeds than what the DNA can tell you. At least that's the potential. In addition, if you can get these RNA molecules and translate them into a snapshot of genetic activity, you can learn perhaps how people were domesticating crops. A particular seed was drought resistant or bloomed earlier in the year. And so it's a new way of perhaps tracking how man worked with ancient crops.
And as far as proteomics, what are scientists learning there?
Well, proteins can survive a lot longer than RNA or even DNA, particularly a few proteins in bone such as collagen and osteocalcin. They can survive hundreds of thousands of years. And people have been studying collagen for different purposes, but the new technique that one group introduced is essentially what they called a barcode of death. They found that collagen molecules differ from species to species. And so they can look at ancient animal bones and draw out the collagen molecules, and then they chop up those molecules into little fragments or peptides. And those peptides have a certain mass fingerprint that differs from species to species. And from that, they realized they could distinguish all sorts of animals. In particular, they saw that there was a subtle difference between sheep and goat. That doesn't sound like a big deal, but archaeologists have had a horrible time separating sheep and goat bones. And so they've had a difficult time teasing out the different stories of how those two animals were domesticated. And this now offers them a way to do that, as well as a way to identify almost any type of animal, if not to the species level, to the genus level.
So it sounds like with these new techniques, it's possible that scientists will be able to identify fossils previously collected but never identified, or perhaps even misidentified.
Definitely. They can even take small fragments of bone that had no distinguishing characteristics, you know, not enough of a shape to even know what bone it was, let alone what species it came from. And by going molecular, by getting the collagen, they can pin an identification on it. And so this is a test that should be pretty cheap if they perfect the technology a little bit more. And so it could open up a lot of different things for the field.
With concerns regarding contamination, is anyone in this growing field of biomolecular archaeology calling for a change in archaeology in the field so that these biomolecular archaeologists have a better chance to analyze untouched fossils and other specimens?
Well, that wasn't a big focus at this meeting. There were relatively few dedicated archaeologists as opposed to the people who are doing this kind of biomolecular studies. But it's certainly a major issue in the field. And for ancient DNA, there have been a lot of work at communicating the best way to handle samples. I think for RNA and proteomics, it's probably a little bit too early to tell what the difficulties will be in terms of how to treat samples in order to prevent contamination or to make them more useful. So it's a little bit too early for a message to go out to the traditional field archaeologist, at least for these new methods.
John Travis, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Rob.
Science's John Travis reports in this week's issue on pioneering studies of preserved molecules, including RNA and proteins, and what the field of biomolecular archaeology may be able to tell us about our past. Also in this week's Science, feeding on blood from birds, people, and livestock. Mosquitoes are among the most important vectors of human disease, and understanding their genetics could go a long way in combating the spread of pathogens. With the genomes of malaria and yellow fever-carrying mosquitoes already sequenced, two papers in this week's Science report on the newly sequenced genome of the third species in the major disease-spreading triad, a mosquito commonly known as the southern house mosquito. This mosquito can carry West Nile virus, St. Louis encephalitis virus, and the parasitic worms that cause lymphatic filariasis, a symptom of which is elephantiasis. In the paper by Peter Arisberger and colleagues, the team reports that the southern house mosquito has a significantly larger and more diverse genome than the other two major disease-spreading mosquito species, allowing it to feed on birds, people, and livestock, meaning that in some cases it can pass pathogens between the species that it feeds on. In a separate study, Lyric Bartholomew and colleagues report 500 immune response-related genes, consistent with the mosquitoes having adapted to diverse habitats like polluted urban centers. In addition, the team finds evidence to support the idea that mosquito-borne pathogens may have evolved to evade the mosquito's own innate immune responses. Read both papers about the southern house mosquito in this week's Science. Now, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about the world's toughest biological material. What is that, Dave?
It is spider silk, Rob, specifically silk that comes from a spider known as the Darwin's bark spider, which hails from Madagascar.
And how do scientists know that this is the toughest biological material?
Well, Rob, first we should probably explain what we mean by tough. That's a word that gets thrown around a lot in our popular discourse. But actually, for scientists, tough has a very specific meaning. Tough means a material that's not only strong, but also very elastic. And the reason they know this spider silk is the world's toughest biomaterial is that they did a lot of searching. There are actually over 40,000 species of spiders in the world, but scientists have only looked at the silk of about 100. And the reason they keep on looking at spider silk is because we know already that spider silk is extremely strong. Most of the silk that's been tested so far is tougher than Kevlar. So if you're looking for a tough material, you're going to look at spider silk. But these researchers wanted to find something that was something that could be used for a range of applications, whether you're talking about bulletproof vests or any other tough, lightweight material. And the reason they focused on this particular spider, the Darwin's bark spider, is because it weaves its webs in very interesting places. It doesn't just pick a corner of a door or a forest or something like that and weave a web. It weaves these webs between trees that are swaying in the wind and weaves webs very close to the surface of the water, say in a river. Very hostile conditions where the web not only has to be really strong, but very elastic, very flexible, especially if one end's attached to a swinging tree, another end's attached to another swinging tree. You can imagine this has to be very tough material.
And so even though scientists haven't tested all 40 plus thousand varieties of spider silk, they're convinced that this is the toughest one?
Well, this is the toughest one they've seen so far. In terms of strength, it was near the top. But what really put it over the edge was its elasticity. It was twice as elastic as any other known spider silk. And when you factor that in, you've got a material that's far stronger. And what they say is the strongest biomaterial or biological material yet discovered.
And you said it's tougher than Kevlar.
It is, Rob. And that's probably because, you know, Mother Nature has been at this for millions of years. Spiders have been evolving for a very long time. And those that don't make super strong webs are basically going to die because they're not going to be able to catch insects and they're not going to be able to eat to survive. Whereas human beings have only been working on creating tough materials like Kevlar for a few decades. So Mother Nature has got a very big head start on us. But we might be able to learn something from continuing to study these spiders.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from spiders spinning webs to the sun lobbing curveballs, this next story is about something called coronal mass ejections.
They come out curving like a curveball?
Well, they can. These ejections are these electrically charged, extremely hot eruptions from the sun's surface that explode from various parts of the sun. They can explode from the middle, what's called the equatorial plane, or near the northern latitudes or the southern latitudes of the sun. And researchers have been paying a lot of attention to these because these ejections can cause havoc here on Earth. They can disrupt GPS satellites, cell phone signals. They can even disrupt power grids and cause power outages. So this is something we're really concerned about. But in the past, what we've really focused on is the ejections that come more from the sun's equatorial plane, because that's the same plane that Earth is on. And scientists had long assumed that if there was an ejection coming from the quote-unquote top or bottom of the sun, those would just sort of go off into space and they weren't going to be a problem for us. But in this new study, scientists use NASA's twin stereo spacecrafts. And these are crafts that are monitoring these coronal mass ejections. And what they saw by analyzing some of these recordings was that even these ejections that come from the top or the bottom of the sun don't necessarily always dissipate out into space. Sometimes they, like a great curveball from a pitcher in the game of baseball, sometimes they turn in a much different direction than expected, and they can actually turn back towards the sun's equatorial plane, and therefore these ejections that we had been ignoring for so long could actually cause a lot of problems.
So something more for space weather forecasters to be on the lookout for.
Exactly. One more thing we have to worry about, unfortunately. But the good news here is that the researchers also showed that we can really monitor these ejections very well with these stereo spacecraft. So even though we have something extra to worry about that we didn't think we had to worry about, we also have a much better way of monitoring this solar activity than we did before. So hopefully we'll have a better way of forecasting these ejections and figuring out just how much damage they're going to do here on Earth.
Is there any way to mitigate that damage, say, if we find out with a few minutes warning that one of these is coming?
Well, yes. These things can cause over $1 trillion worth of damage and cause problems that could take 10 years to repair. One of the things researchers can do if they know one of these ejections is really going to have an impact on Earth is they can take satellites and put them in what they call safe mode that would protect the satellite from damage or prevent a loss in GPS or other types of satellite communications. And as to the damage here on Earth, it's hard to know.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, getting back down to Earth, this last story is about earthquakes and what role dust plays in making them happen.
Dust is involved?
Well, it is involved. And actually, the geologists don't call it dust. They call it fault gouge. And basically what this is, if you can imagine two plates sort of rubbing against each other, it's going to create dust, just as if you were to rub two rocks together really hard. And researchers already knew that this dust or fault gouge could help power earthquakes. And the reason is because there's a lot of friction involved. And actually this dust has a coating of water around it. And having that dust around actually helps the plates slip past each other a lot easier. And if you have a plate slip past another one very quickly, or relatively quickly, that's essentially what happens when you have at least one type of earthquake.
So what is it about this dust that powers the earthquake?
Well, Rob, here's essentially what happens. And the way the researchers found this out was they actually took these 5-centimeter-tall granite plugs and essentially created almost like an earthquake fault in the lab with these two guys pressed very hard against each other. And what they found is initially what happens is when these plugs start moving against each other, it creates this fault gouge, this dust that we talked about. And that acts as a bit of a lubricant because this dust has a coating of water on it. And it causes these plugs to start moving faster against each other. But then you get so much friction and so much heat that this water on the dust evaporates. And now all of a sudden you've got much more friction than you had before. And these plugs, or in the real world, these plates, stop moving as fast against each other. And that theoretically should stop the earthquake. But the problem is you've already built up so much pressure and heat at that point that eventually the pressure becomes too much. And these guys essentially break. In other words, they start moving much faster against each other. And that results in what in the real world would be an earthquake, which researchers have defined as these plates moving against each other at a speed of about 1 meter a second.
And the researchers were able to create this level of pressure that's equivalent to 2 plates under the earth in the lab?
Well, they were, or at least they tried, Rob, but they did it on a much smaller scale. And that's actually one of the criticisms of the study, is that these conditions in the lab don't exactly replicate what you would see in the real world. So it's a little hard to draw concrete conclusions about just how applicable these findings are to real world earthquakes. But at least thanks to this experiment, we're learning a little bit more about this mysterious dust that seems to play a much larger role in earthquakes than researchers had previously thought.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into on the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about hepatitis B in songbirds, and also a story about underwater robots that resemble stingrays. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about the government dipping into geoengineering research. And geoengineering is this idea of trying to create man-made strategies that would help cool the planet, everything from launching tiny mirrors into space to seeding the ocean with billions of tiny bubbles. And also a story about women in science. Women have really been making big gains in science in terms of the degrees they're attaining. But a new report says that when you get beyond the doctoral level, the ratio of women to men starts to drop. And this report is trying to figure out exactly why that happens. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. Finally, today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is our letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, 2 letters about scientific publishing. We start with a letter in this week's issue, written in response to an August 20th News Focus story titled "Free Journals Grow Amid Ongoing Debate" by Science's Jocelyn Kaiser. That article takes a look at the 10 years of the open access campaign for free journals such as the Public Library of Science and their flagship publication, PLOS ONE.
Jacques Zimmer of the Laboratory of Immunogenetics and Allergology in Luxembourg writes in to take issue with the unnamed critics in Kaiser's article who, as Zimmer writes, accuse PLOS journals, particularly PLOS ONE, of publishing nearly all submissions, regardless of scientific value, simply to make money.
As a member of the editorial board of PLOS ONE, writes Zimmer, I must say that at least in my field of immunology, it is simply not true that the journal accepts bad science. Most of the papers I handle as an academic editor are of high quality and could qualify for acceptance by more conventional high-impact journals. At times, negative results are published, as they could be very important for other scientists in the field.
Zimmer concludes, if I am an expert in the field and totally convinced by the data of a manuscript, then I act as the reviewer and accept it, with any relevant suggestions for improvement. If I have doubts, I send it out for peer review. If the paper is too weak, I reject it. This is exactly what editors of conventional journals do. PLOS ONE is a serious journal that aims to render well-performed science accessible to everybody.
You can read Zimmer's letter in this week's issue of Science. Our other letter on scientific publishing is from Donald Siegel of Syracuse University in the United States and Philippe Bivet of Abertay University in the United Kingdom. The authors write, "The academic community continues to believe that the formal scholarly publishing process separates sound research from shoddy or biased counterparts. Unfortunately, scholarly publishing may not be able to effectively fulfill its role as a gatekeeper much longer."
As soon as the publish or perish concept surfaced in the United States in the early 1950s, the authors continue, academics criticized it openly as a recipe for disaster. Nevertheless, in the early to mid-1980s, administrators in universities systematically began to use the number of articles published per year by individual faculty members as a measure of their productivity.
The shift transformed scholarly publishing, the authors continue. Researchers began salami slicing their manuscripts in ever smaller, least publishable units, and began rushing manuscripts to publication before proper replication or evaluation of results. Multi-authored manuscripts increased, regardless of true contribution to the work. Doctoral students began to write dissertations as a series of publishable chapters, some submitted even before the defense. As a result, the quantity of articles published in scholarly journals increased on average by about 200% to 300% from the early 1980s to the late 1990s.
The top journals are now flooded with numbers of manuscripts beyond most editors' capacity to handle. The authors continue, reviewers are solicited to scrutinize not just manuscripts, but also research proposals and governmental reports. Yet peer reviewing is rarely, if ever, valued by academic institutions as a fruitful way for researchers to spend their time. So finding good reviewers has become more and more difficult.
The authors conclude, researchers need to fight to contain the current paper glut. The number of articles published per year should never be used, under any circumstance, as a criterion in tenure or promotion decisions, or to rank academic institutions. University administrators should consider peer reviewing as not only legitimate, but a vitally important way for researchers to contribute to scholarship, and should reward it as such. Journals should demand that for every paper submitted, an author provide 3 reviews of other manuscripts. Perhaps if authors knew that their reviewing workload would increase dramatically with the number of papers they submit, they would craft fewer and better papers, ultimately benefiting all involved.
You can find the full letter in the September 17th issue of Science. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor of Science Magazine. And that wraps up the October 1st, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. Thanks to Sophia Kai for her help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.